Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor-in-chief of the New Books Network, and I'd like to tell you about another terrific podcast called Historically Thinking. It's hosted by Al Zambone, a historian, and every week Al talks to historians about how they do their work and about their books and about history in general. This is a wonderful podcast, and it's one of our favorites at the New Books Network, and I really encourage you to subscribe to Historically Thinking. You can go to historicallythinking.org and learn all about it. It's on Apple Podcasts, and you can subscribe there, and we'd like to give you a little taste of Historically Thinking, so we're going to republish some of Al's terrific episodes, such as the one that follows. I hope you enjoy it.
Welcome to Historically Thinking, a program devoted to all kinds of historical knowledge and to the ways that we achieve it. I'm your host, Al Zambone. Our website is historicallythinking.org, where you can subscribe, find more information about our guests, links, and related readings. Our email address is mail@historicallythinking.org. We'd love to hear from you.
Hello. The metaphor object lesson is a familiar one, still in everyday use. But what exactly does that metaphor refer to? In her book Object Lessons, How 19th Century Americans Learned to Make Sense of the Material World, my guest Sarah Ann Carter reveals that object lessons were a classroom exercise in wide use during the 19th century. Her book is a study of intellectual history, but also of intellectual culture, a fascinating story of how what happened in the classroom came to shape the language of politics and advertising. Sarah Ann Carter is curator and director of research at the Chipstone Foundation in Milwaukee. She also teaches at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and has published, lectured, and taught courses on material culture, museum practice, and American cultural history. Sarah, thank you for being on Historically Thinking.
Thanks so much for having me.
So we were talking a little bit before we began about Chipstone, the Chipstone Foundation. What is the Chipstone Foundation, other than kind of a very cool name?
Well, the name actually is quite a funny story, which I can tell you, but the Chipstone Foundation is a private foundation based in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, that focuses on collecting early American decorative art. So American furniture, American and British ceramics, and American prints. But we're also quite interested in innovative museum practice. And for the past 20 years, we've curated exhibitions at the Milwaukee Art Museum and have collaborated with museums all over the country. We run a think tank program where we work with institutions that are trying to better meet their mission and looking for ways to be creative and innovative. And we also teach undergraduate students about decorative arts and material culture.
So the subject that we're tackling here of object lessons is very interesting because it is, as I said, it's educational history, it's intellectual history, it's intellectual culture, but it's very close to how you spend your day-to-day existence as a curator of objects and bringing them to people's attention. Is that right? You're really touching a vein that's close to your heart here.
It absolutely is. And in this book project, in my book, I'm thinking a lot about how people understood how you could move from objects to ideas, mm-hmm. how you could go from the study of a material thing to understanding the larger world around that thing, what that thing might imply, how that thing could help us understand and unlock aspects of social and cultural history. Mm-hmm. in the work that I do at Shipstone, we do a great deal of object teaching. A lot of the work that we do is very much focused on starting with a material thing and then helping students think about innovative and creative ways those objects could help us tell stories about the past and the present and their relationship to each other. Mm-hmm.
So we begin the book with a really curious revelation, perhaps for some. I kind of was vaguely aware of this, but I hadn't realized how important the Swiss connection was to 19th century American educational theorists. So it all begins with that very curious and eccentric Swiss educator Pestalozzi, looking out the window at a ladder. So let's explain about windows and ladders here and who he was and how he starts this up.
Yes. So Johann Heinrich Pestalozzi was basically your classic romantic hero. He had all sorts of big ideas, but his personal life and personally, he seemed to pretty much be a big mess. And he was really fascinated in the ways that children learned. And he really wanted to find ways to help children and the teachers who came to work with him learn more about how to truly understand and make sense of the world. And some of his earlier writings, he really focused on mothers and motherhood. And he noticed that mothers seem to truly understand their children better than anyone else and understood childhood better than anyone else because they were constantly observing their children. They were looking closely. They were trying to make sense of their children and the patterns. Al, I'm getting all tongue-tied.
That's right. They're trying to make sense of their children. Yeah, and patterns.
Johann Heinrich Pestalozzi was pretty much your classic romantic hero. In descriptions of him, he looks like a madman. His socks are falling down because he's not, he hasn't, fixed them properly at his calves. He's often missing his shoe buckles, which he'll describe as having given away to some poor family. His hair is disheveled. I mean, there are crazy stories of him just running through the streets almost looking like a madman. But he was also a brilliant educator. And he had these big ideas that you learn the most from children by looking closely at them and observing them and understanding how they observe the world. And so there are these quite famous and possibly apocryphal stories of Pestalozzi developing this whole system of learning by realizing that rather than teaching children with pictures of things, with Anschauung Unterricht, which were these sense perception cards that were quite popular in the late 18th and early 19th century, instead of using pictures of things, children could best learn with the things themselves. And the things themselves would inspire much more thoughtful observation, they would inspire connections, they would activate the children's minds in new ways, and in the process, change their train their senses. And so, quite famously, there's a story in which Pestalozzi is in a classroom with students, and they're looking at pictures of the ladder, and then one of his students points out the window, and there is the ladder itself out the window in the courtyard. And he realizes we should turn to things, not just their mere representation. Mm-hmm. So that becomes the foundation of a whole set of classroom exercises that he and his many student teachers developed over the course of many years in a series of schools throughout Europe.
So Pestalozzi is himself a sort of stop on the grand tour for certain interested, for interested Europeans and for English persons and I guess the occasional American. What do they learn from him?
Well, Pestalozzi, he creates a culture and a system in which educational innovation is really encouraged. Mm-hmm. And he was not a very good administrator, most romantic heroes, not very good administrators, but really good at coming up with ideas and possibilities. And so many of the teachers who came through his various schools, particularly people like Charles Mayo, who would go on with his sister to develop a whole school around object lessons, he created opportunities for a range of younger teachers, teachers in training, visitors, to experience a totally new way of teaching. And This was often rooted in observation. This teaching was rooted in close looking, and it was not rooted in memorization and in text. Mm-hmm. And so it was quite a different way to teach children. And it became the foundation for a whole range of 19th century pedagogies that really transformed the way people thought about learning and how children could learn and experience the world. And Charles Mayo is probably one of his most famous students, because he would then return to England and, working with his sister, Elizabeth Mayo, develop a school system that developed the home and colonial schools, which would train teachers in object lesson methods, who would then be sent throughout the British Empire at that time to teach children all over the world the value of looking closely at things rather than looking at pictures.
So there's a direct influence from Pestalozzi or his works or writings about him to very influential Americans. Bronson Alcott, who is perhaps not the best example of a successful schoolmaster. Another romantic hero. But much more importantly, Dorothea Dix. And then Horace mm-hmm. Mann. Did Mann, I'm not sure, he read Pestalozzi. Did he visit he visited Switzerland to get ideas at some point, did he not?
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure. I'm not sure if he studied directly with Pestalozzi in one of his schools.
Uh-huh. And then there are these Swiss. There's Kruzzi, who is one of Pestalozzi's. Mm-hmm. He comes to the United States. Mm-hmm. And then there's Louis Agassiz. I always mispronounce his name.
Agassiz,
right. Who mm-hmm. teaches natural history at Harvard for ages and ages. So what do these people bring with them? There's that famous story. I looked this up as I was reading your book. You don't mention it, but it's the story of Agassiz and the fish. And that story seems to convey something of an attention to real things. I can post by a very famous entomologist who Agassiz taught mm-hmm. at Harvard.
I've made a video about that.
Okay. Tell the story then. I mean, because I think that gets to the attention, this sort of Pestalozzi influence on attending to real objects.
Mm-hmm. A man by the name of Scudder was one of Agassiz's students at Harvard. And Scudder was, a young student of Agassiz, and he turns up, and rather than being able to study all sorts of, sighting animals and things that he had wanted to do, Agassiz basically gave him a fish.
Yeah.
And for weeks and weeks, he told Scudder, you just have to look at this fish. You just have to try to understand this object, and gave him no further instructions.
And he would learn sort of basically laboratory technique, keeping this fish, preserved fish, moist with alcohol as he studied it and dissected it. That was sort of the first lesson. And then
we had to learn how to maintain this specimen.
Yeah.
But even more importantly, what he realized was that just a cursory look at the specimen was not going to reveal what he needed to truly understand it.
Mm-hmm.
And that gradually, smelling like these chemicals or preserving this fish, going home frustrated day after day, he gradually came to realize that there was a pattern here. There was something that he needed to notice in looking at this fish. And one of his first observations was that, this fish is it's symmetrical, right? This is one observation, one pattern that might not be initially apparent in looking at a specimen.
Right.
But yet that's a crucial observation when you're thinking about histories of zoology, to begin to understand that as something that is a way to understand organisms. So that kind of observation, that kind of close looking, is very much in keeping with many of the things that Pestalozzi was teaching and talking about. When Agassiz, when he would run teachers' institutes in the early 19th century in New England, he would, bring insects and give every member of the institute a grasshopper, for example, where those teachers in training could look closely and observe and try to really understand what it was they were looking at, not through his description, not through an image of those insects, which, of course, all images are a kind of argument and are a kind of analysis.
Yes.
But through the thing itself, forcing those teachers to really make sense of what they were looking at.
So that through it, we could get really philosophical or even neurobiological here, but they're having to engage in almost a relationship with the object itself.
Yes.
Rather than that representation or interpretation of an object.
Right, exactly. And there was an understanding that it was through engaging with the thing itself, you were not just learning about that object, but you were learning patterns of thinking and observation.
So could you give an example of how would an object lesson work then? A very simple one. Because that's one of the difficulties with, I think, in an understanding sort of the book is to figure out how this actually worked in the classroom, because it happens in different ways in different classrooms. So what's a sort of simple object lesson? If I was given, I don't know, some examples in the book of sugar or of a cruet of vinegar, how would a teacher, how would you lead students through that?
Well, the examples that you bring up, like on sugar or vinegar, in those cases, it would depend on, you know, the age of the student and very much in the context of who's leading that lesson. But I could imagine in a classic five-part object lesson, like the kind of lesson that the Mayos really advocated at the home and colonial schools, you would start with the basic observation of that object. Let's say it is sugar. You might look closely at it. You might figure out, you know, what color is it? What are some of the basic qualities of this object, right? You'd begin to look closely and try to discern, you know, is it white? Is it sparkling? Like, what are some of the basic qualities of this object? What are qualities that perhaps could be developed through engaging with it? Is it sweet? You know, what is it that makes this what people say it is? So initially, from the very beginning, and going through this process of engaging with a substance or a thing, the student and the teacher is leading them through this exercise are asking the student, and they're asking themselves to challenge the notion that you can just memorize that the substance is called sugar. You are really being asked to understand, you know, what is this thing in front of me? What is this substance in front of me that I'm engaging with, right? Mm-hmm. And so you're trying to understand, what are the qualities of this substance? What makes this what I think it is? How do I define this material? And then from there, moving out from there to understand maybe what are qualities that I cannot discern through my senses. What's additional information that a teacher might want to give a student about this substance? So, for example, where is it coming from? Is it foreign or domestic? Is it in something that's imported? Is it something that has medicinal qualities? Is it something that has other sorts of functions or contexts that I couldn't get just from looking at it or just from tasting it or just from engaging with it, right? Mm-hmm. Then students would be led to really think through, how might I sort or organize this thing? Is it a vegetable? Is it a mineral? Is it an animal? Is it a spice? Is it edible? Is it what? You know, how do I define this thing? What are the categories in which I would put this thing to help me make sense of it? Mm-hmm. And then finally, students would be asked to write about it, to actually write a composition in which they put together all of that information. So in essence, go ahead.
Are they building it on previous information, like they know what sugar cane is, for example, when they're trying to answer the question about vegetable?
In some cases. Uh-huh. In some cases they are, depending on the age of the students. Mm-hmm. In some cases the teacher might tell them that could be information that they're given. Mm-hmm. But there are certainly many instances in which students are just given the substance itself and then the other information is brought to bear on it in class discussions. Mm-hmm. There are other cases in which sugar might be placed within a network of other materials or images to help fill in some of that context. But the goal is to develop a pattern of thinking that started with close looking and observation. You know, a whole range of empirical observation, whether it is looking closely or it could be, you know, tasting or touching or smelling or listening, you know, if it has a metallic quality to it, to listen to what that object sounds like. To go from those kinds of physical details, those sensory details, the training of one's sense perception, to understanding the broader context in which that thing was created or how it exists in the world or where it comes from, figuring out what categories or patterns it might be part of, mm-hmm. and then synthesizing that information to actually write about that object. So in a lot of ways, the practice becomes a way to teach patterns of thinking, and it also could be considered almost a prehistory to contemporary material culture scholarship.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It becomes a way to think about how do we understand the history of getting ideas from things.
Yeah. I was very struck as you discussed this. It's not just vinegar. It's not just sugar. It's not just ladders. It's also history, that object lessons could teach history. You describe Sheldon Barnes,
mm-hmm.
who came up with a series of books, studies in general history, studies in Greek and Roman history, studies in American history. And she included, quote, personal narratives, letters, laws, and maps, as well as an image of artifacts, such as wooden-soled shoes worn by a Confederate soldier and representations of places, such as a sketch of a mining camp in Denver. That sounds like such a modern textbook.
Oh, absolutely. And Mary Sheldon Barnes is a fascinating character. So her father is a man named E.A. Sheldon, who was responsible for popularizing object lessons in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So he gets exposed to a whole range of object lesson pedagogies in upstate New York, in Oswego, New York, just across Lake Ontario from Toronto, and he goes to Ryerson and gets exposed to all of these different kinds of object-based study methods, all of these different object lesson materials, which were created by the home and colonial schools
in
London.
And Canada, of course, is part of the colonial side of home and colonial schools. Yeah, got it.
Exactly. And so those materials are very much in use there, and they're the cutting-edge materials in the late 1850s, early 1860s. And he brings those materials back to Oswego, where he transforms the school system there, and later the Oswego State Normal School, which goes on to become SUNY Oswego, really becomes a center of object lesson instruction in the United States.
And what decade is this? This is the
1860s. Yeah.
It's really, as I said in the notes to you, it's really always astounding to me how Western New York seems to have been the center for every possible kind of reform movement in the middle of the 19th century.
It's pretty amazing. I mean, it must have been a fascinating place. And
it must have been.
Yeah, it makes me think, too, about, you know, these hubs of innovation.
Even exactly.
You think about, if you're going to be, like, in Cambridge or, you know, San Francisco, there's all sorts of innovation happening in all these different areas. You have to wonder if there's somehow an openness there.
No one ever mentions, Rochester, the sort of triangle, Rochester, Syracuse, and Oswego. Here you've got, everything from Mormonism to object lessons comes out of this very small space.
Exactly. So you just wonder if there's somehow an openness. An openness there to innovation. It's pretty exciting. So Sheldon creates this whole school there, which is focused not on memorization, not on rote learning, but on really on trying to understand how children think and learn through their engagement with objects. And so his daughter, Mary Sheldon Barnes, who, goes on to graduate school, becomes a historian, it makes a great deal of sense that she would be completely fascinated by what we would think of today as this primary source-based curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
Right? She wants her students to turn to the actual stuff of history, the material sources that really help us understand larger historical narratives and really become these like touchstones to help students really try to understand these larger patterns. And of course, the same moment she's writing all these textbooks, there are a whole range of historians focused on material culture, publishing books like Alice Morse Early and others, thinking about putting material sources in their texts about early America as a way of further documenting histories of everyday life. So there's this late 19th century interest in collecting and in documenting those objects and sources. And Mary Sheldon Barnes has really transformed that into a way to teach the practice of doing history.
One of the things that she's trying to do is create citizens by studying documents. And this harks back to her father and others, that studying objects to them was central to developing reason and morals, both simultaneously. So we've kind of touched on this before, but let's make it more explicit. How did studying objects, first of all, develop one's reason?
Well, when you're studying a material thing, and this I think of this today with my own students when I'm teaching, oftentimes with objects in the classroom, you are presented with something in front of you and not a text that can be repeated back. Mm-hmm. And in doing that, you have to look closely. You have to make your own observations. And you have to be able to make connections between what you see in front of you and ideas or questions you may have. You also have to be able to defend your ideas and your thoughts in relation to something that sits in front of you on the table, mm-hmm. not a book that can be closed and put away, not a text that you can memorize and pare it back, mm-hmm. but you're actually being forced to engage with the realities of something in front of you. And through that process, you're learning to synthesize those observations with things you might already know, things you might wonder about, questions you may have, and develop those ideas and thoughts out of that observation, out of that experience with a material thing. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's a way of training reasoning and thinking, and also of empowering students to understand that they can look closely at something and they can develop observations, they can ask questions, they can develop an argument or a narrative coming out of that thing that, of course, can be challenged and talked through. But it gives one a starting point, and it gives one a way to think about and engage with the world from their own perspective.
Very powerful idea. How did they see it as developing one's morality?
Well, it was often talked about as, you know, once you actually face the world and are able to look closely at something, mm-hmm. you are going to be able to make better judgment. Mm-hmm. You are not going to assume that what someone tells you is true. And so there are several texts, particularly during the 1860s, that argued that if only Americans had learned to reason, had learned how to look closely and to develop their own understanding of the world through close looking and observation, you know, perhaps there wouldn't be the crisis of slavery that America was, you know, grappling with, you know, throughout the 1860s. There wouldn't be, and obviously for decades and decades prior to that, there wouldn't be a question about integrity of a shopkeeper, someone trying to trick you. You would know, you would be a better consumer, you would be a better citizen, you would be able to make better decisions because you had been looking closely, you'd been trying to understand the world around you. You were trained to actually make your decisions based on the things that you were presented with, and you weren't just parroting back what someone else was telling you. You weren't vulnerable to King Sham.
You were
in fact your own person because you had learned how to experience the world.
So this is what in fact Sheldon Barnes says in the preface to Studies in American History that you quote, what is more to our purpose is only by dealing with the sources of past history that our pupils can be rightly trained to deal with historic sources of his own time and to form independent and unprejudiced judgments concerning the mass of opinions, actions, institutions, and social products of all sorts in which he finds himself involved. In other words, whatever else our young people will become, citizens they must be, and the citizen must constantly form judgments of the historical sort.
Yes.
That sounds like, I mean, that with some editing, that could be Sam Weinberg. I've just been reading a lot of Sam Weinberg lately and talking to him soon, recording a conversation with him soon. And that does sound mm-hmm. an awful lot like Sam. It's very interesting.
Yeah. And I find the arguments that she's making and that other object teachers from this period making feel very relevant.
They do. They really
do. Because there's this concern then, as there is now, that the students are not actually learning how to engage with the sources that we're being presented with every day.
Or with people.
How to engage critically with those sources. Pardon?
Or with people.
Or with people, exactly.
Or with real things are the anxiety of even those who are just slightly older than our students, but who are not have not been brought up in the virtual world to the extent that our anxieties about the virtual world are in many ways expressed by the people who developed object lessons and spread them.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
How did object lessons spread?
Well, it's interesting. As a pedagogy, there was this notion that one could not necessarily just read about it in a book initially, mm-hmm. but had to experience it. And so throughout the early days of the practice in in England and then throughout the British Empire. So, you know, in the 1830s, 40s, and 50s, you know, it spread through teachers trained in the home and colonial schools. And then starting in the 1860s in the U.S., it spread through teachers trained in the Oswego method. And it really becomes one of the first educational fads. So very early on in the 1860s, as soon as teachers start getting trained in this method, they're being sent out through common schools throughout the U.S. where they are teaching classes in object lessons, where object lessons start to appear actually as part of the curriculum as a separate class in schools throughout the U.S. at that point. And it's really through these trained teachers who are leading lessons in object-based studying that that it begins to spread and becomes very much a common way to talk about material things. And there also are a number of educational publishing houses that are publishing books about object lessons and also publishing object lesson teaching aids, yeah, which are not necessarily strictly object lessons in the way they might have been defined by Pestalozzi and the Mayos, but they become really important ways to spread this pedagogy as well.
You have some beautiful pictures in the book of these, they're art in themselves, really, this mahogany box mm-hmm. of materials with probably, you say, for use in Elizabeth Mayo's lessons on objects, mm-hmm. with four trays divided with all tiny specimens of various things, coral, granite, I see lace, and so on, mm-hmm. all which can be brought out and passed around and touched, and chains of reasoning built from them.
Right, exactly. And these things themselves become not just stand-ins for words, but actually a way to try to develop and understand the concepts. And one talks about cotton. Wow, there's a whole world one might mean when one says cotton. There's raw cotton. There are all different kinds of textiles created from cotton. There's the plant itself. There's, you know, all different other, there's a whole range of materials that could be developed mm-hmm. from that one substance.
Yeah, you have
these kinds of boxes allow you to see that.
Mm-hmm. You have a moving, I think, anecdote of basically the children who had recently been enslaved having to think through cotton.
Yes, yeah. And object lessons become quite popular actually at the Hampton Normal School at what would become the Hampton Institute, now Hampton University in Virginia. And object lessons were used extensively there for students of all ages in different ways. But there's one object lesson in particular where students were taught to engage with raw cotton. And actually there's a photograph of them rubbing this cotton through their fingers, thinking about how this ball of cotton could become a thread. Mm-hmm. And that, is a very interesting relationship to put those students to a substance like cotton, where, their families, and this is a little bit later, so their families had, many of their families had likely been enslaved mm-hmm. and had been, working with cotton. Many of their families could have been sharecroppers. And then at the same time, lessons for students in the North about cotton really would put students much more in a relationship to cotton as a consumer substance, mm-hmm. not as something that they might be picking or producing or getting from the fields, but different kinds of cotton they might purchase in a store, different kinds of printed cotton, different kinds of textiles that they can engage with as consumers, not as producers. So object lessons were designed initially to really open up students' minds. They got students to look closely to learn how to reason, but of course, like any pedagogy, they're not neutral. It's not a neutral pedagogy. Mm-hmm. And the ways those lessons are framed, whether for African-American students at Hampton or students in upstate New York who are primarily white students in a place like Oswego, those lessons might be very different, mm-hmm. even though they might be with the same substance.
Yeah.
And that's part of the history of object lessons that is complicated and important to engage with, and it's also quite relevant for those of us who teach with objects today in our classroom. Because objects can raise a whole range of powerful associations
yeah.
that are quite connected to race and class. national origin, identity, all different kinds of categories that we have to be attentive to.
Well, certainly what's the powerful about an object is that one object can have so many different, they can have, if there are 15 people in the room, all 15 people could have 15 different types of relationship to it.
Right, right, which is part of why it's so interesting that an object lesson pedagogy and in many other 20th and 21st century material culture pedagogies, students are encouraged to engage with objects through a regimented set of practices.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So if we were to put an object in front of you and me and to just have us write about that object, say, you know, write a composition about this coffee cup, we might get very different things. But if we were to preface that experience with the steps of an object lesson,
mm-hmm.
where we would be attentive to the materials of that cup, its colors, its design, what it looks like, how it feels, what it does, understanding, you know, cultural categories in which we could put that object, understanding things that perhaps we can't get just through close looking. Our final essays about that cup would certainly be different, but they would be rooted in material understandings of that object.
Yeah, I see. I see.
And so, yeah, these kinds of processes, you know, or today in the 20th and 21st centuries, thinking about something like, you know, Jules Krauss's quite famous essay, Mind and Matter, which, you know, came out in the early 80s, but is still very much used to teach object lessons today, very much used to teach material culture today, is very similar to these historic object lesson methods.
Mm-hmm.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Let's talk a little bit more about the Hampton Institute. You have a chapter where you deal with the questions of object lessons and race and citizenship. And you've suggested to me before we started recording that object lessons to some extent became stigmatized because they were regarded as things done in African American schools. Is I don't know if that's a fair repetition of your thought, but how were object lessons used in places like Hampton Institute? Were they used differently than in white schools?
Well, at places like Hampton, object lessons were used for slightly older children.
Mm-hmm.
Because Hampton is both a school for African Americans and for Native Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And so object lessons were used for both of those groups quite extensively in the 1870s and 80s. And part of that use was based in some really quite racist ideas about how African American and Native American students would best learn how to engage with the world. And the idea was that object lessons could help make abstract ideas more concrete.
Mm-hmm.
And they could also help train those students' senses in ways that they could really grasp onto and understand these material things and then the larger world that they suggested. And
that,
so
that their modes of reasoning were somehow racially inferior and therefore they needed a leg up. Okay.
And therefore they needed this particular kind of pedagogy, which when it was conceptualized was not conceptualized as something that would be used to fill any sort of perceived racial difference, but the idea was that they were for everybody, mm-hmm. that everyone could benefit from this. But they started to be, the pedagogy started to be twisted in a lot of ways to be used for older African American and Native American students. And some African American parents at Hampton we're not happy about this. You know, there's a newspaper account of parents writing and saying they wanted their children to learn to read, not
I was struck by that. We've had a previous conversation about Reconstruction and about the passion for learning, all students doing lots of homework and learning how to read within months after the end of the Civil War.
That was a crucial skill that you needed to acquire in school. That's why you were going to school. And object lessons sort of delayed that. And there wasn't as much of a focus on literacy because there was this, you know, expansive, mind-opening focus on observation and, you know, close looking. But if you are a recently enslaved parent who's just gained your freedom, you want your child to develop the crucial skill they had been denied under slavery.
You don't want a bunch
them to learn to read.
You don't want a bunch of Montessori hippies coming down from the north to
And you certainly don't want your child in school to be, you know, playing with a ball of cotton.
Exactly.
Right?
No.
They should be there learning to read.
Yeah.
And I think object teachers had very good intentions. Not all, but for the most part, I think there was this idea that, oh, we're going to teach these children how to learn. But there was also that was happening in a very racist and racialized way in those schools. And I think it's quite important to remember that and to think about that. So when I teach with objects, when I do object teaching today in the 21st century, I feel very, responsible that I need to be attentive to that racist history in my work and to think about how I can try to acknowledge that history and then try to still use object-based learning and object teaching in a positive way. Because another interesting aspect of object lesson pedagogy at places like Hampton was that it was also explicitly used to teach children how to be servants.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's really there's this mind-opening history in object lessons and object-based pedagogy, but there's a much darker history too that has to be that really has to be brought into the story as well. I mean, there was a whole movement called the Kitchen Garden Movement, which was a play on kindergarten.
Yeah.
And the idea was that object-based lessons, object lesson like pedagogy, which would actually become the foundation for the kindergarten movement in the 19th century Europe and later the United States, those same kinds of lessons could be used to teach children what it felt like to be servants.
Mm-hmm.
And what I mean is to truly, like, what were the bodily or the somatic qualities of a servant that you could teach a child to develop, whether it's listening for the door or properly solving someone's soup or being able to not show their emotions. Those were things that a servant needed to learn how to do that could be taught through sensory training. And so object lesson methods were also applied to those ends as well.
It's interesting that, I think we need to think about that a little bit more. They're trying to teach something about being a servant, and we have to contrast that with the children's parents' previous experience of slavery, in which the instruction was very different. There's something interesting there, but it would have to take some time for me to tease out. There's going to be some sort of sense of dignity, racialized undoubtedly, but some sort of difference in dignity between the two. It's certainly not the vision of that W.B. Du Bois had for the African American future. But
no, of course, there's no doubt about that. I just think it's important to acknowledge that. With object lesson methods, with all of those mind-opening possibilities of this pedagogy, is teaching critical thinking and teaching reasoning skills and teaching close looking, all of those same skills, which have very positive ends and outcomes, were also used in places like Hampton, but also in the Northeast, particularly to teach Irish immigrants, our Irish girls, how to change your body in such a way that you could be a better servant. And so
I'm just thinking what happened when they got the Italians. But anyway, go on. Sorry.
Right. That's just part of this pedagogy. Yeah. Part of the history of this pedagogy.
Yeah. It's interesting. Yeah. We could do a whole, you could write a whole book on educational fads is cruel, but educational techniques and how the declension in the second or third generation from original intent. I mean, because it seems to happen all the time. And anyway. Object lessons now, is a metaphor we use without having any idea of the educational background. And you devote some time to understanding how that happened and how object lessons became part of advertising and politics. Could you explain mm-hmm. that to me a little bit?
Sure. So as you say, we all might know the metaphor of object lesson without actually knowing its history. And what was so fascinating to me was they came to realize that this common metaphor actually hid quite a common classroom practice in the late 19th century. And one of the things that I traced throughout my research was where and how the metaphor of the object lesson appeared in a whole range of different kinds of texts and places. And what became so fascinating to me was to realize that object lessons were used as both a classroom practice and as a metaphor at the same time, particularly in places like Hampton, in relation to African-American and Native American students learning there. Booker T. Washington and others explicitly referred to those students as learning by object lessons and themselves living object lessons and what could be made of an African-American or a Native American student through education. Mm-hmm. And so there are moments like that where the pedagogy the phrase object lesson is being used both to describe the pedagogy and as a metaphor. Mm-hmm. And that's when you start to see sort of this slippage between these two different ways of using that language. And because object lessons were so incredibly popular in the mid-19th century, a popularity, again, that the metaphor itself hides, mm-hmm. Because we think of it as a metaphor, not as actually a practice. I mean, it was in schools throughout the United States. I spent a great deal of time going through the curricula of many, many school districts, and it's everywhere in the 1860s, 70s, and 80s. And so people were familiar with this term. And so when it starts to slip into the metaphor, in the context of Hampton or the Carlisle Indian School and other places, the metaphor itself begins to become disaggregated from its use as classroom pedagogy. And then, politicians, advertisers, writers really start to use it as a way to talk about any sort of reasoning from concrete to abstract.
It is really extraordinary how it spreads so quickly.
And part of that is because it's not just an object lesson. We might think of it today, this is what I just said, it's an example of going from concrete to abstract. Uh-huh. But in the 19th century, it also very much implied that there was something really meaningful happening in that process of looking closely and going to an idea about that thing. Because part of what the object lesson did that was so powerful was it rooted abstract ideas in material things. Mm-hmm. Because once you've gone through this five-step lesson, once you've looked closely and thought about the larger context of this object and sorted your observations and you've written something about it, that thing that you've written is really deeply rooted in that object. But your text isn't just something that's loosely connected to that material thing, but instead, through this almost spiral-like process, starting with the object at the center, you are really creating something that is very closely connected to the material thing. It's as if it must be true because it's connected to that object. You are going through a reasoning process, right? And so the metaphor becomes a very powerful way to think about the world. So when an advertiser uses it and pulls out a bar of soap and says, this is an object lesson in good soap, you're not just saying, that's a great bar of soap. By thinking about the rhetoric behind it, you're actually going through a process of imagining this is something that has been proven and tested and understood through deep engagement with this thing. Mm-hmm. There's more to that metaphor than just a concrete example.
How was it used in politics?
It was used in lots of different ways. I think my favorite example has to be as part of a presidential campaign. Grover Cleveland's 1892 campaign, in which he actually created a pair of object lessons on tin cards. So It was an object lesson actually in tariffs, something that is more relevant today than I thought it would be when I started working on this project. But the idea was that you'd actually print, he printed what he called a McKinley tariff object lesson, not on a piece of paper, but on a sheet of tin. And these two object lesson cards actually made out of tin were became a lesson in trying to understand the problems of the McKinley tariff on lots of things, including tin. And so, for example, part of it was you were looking at a sheet that was listed as imported tin plate, but you couldn't tell the difference between that imported tin plate and something that was not imported. Or voters, I guess, or students of this particular kind of political object lesson were instructed to really think about what does it mean for this to be American tin versus imported tin? What are all the steps in that process? And, of course, as you're doing this, you're holding a piece of that metal in your hand, and you're looking at it and you're studying it, and it is embodying this political argument that he's making. And actually, throughout the various tariff debates of the early 1890s, there are lots of different object lessons on the different commodities that are being taxed. And it becomes a really interesting way to force or to encourage or to try to drive citizens to look closely at the things around them and to understand how and why do I interact with this thing? Where does it come from? Should it be taxed? Why or why not? Am I actually looking closely at the products around me? And this is something, you know, I've been thinking about a lot lately. You know, I'm from Milwaukee. That's where I'm from, Boston, but I live in Milwaukee now. And, you know, thinking about how the recent tariff debates have been framed in terms of, you know, a beer can. We make a lot of beer here. You know, what does it mean for that particular object, right? Asking asking citizens not just to think about, or voters not just to think about an abstract concept of tin, but to look at the thing itself. And that was very much part of political discourse in this period, in terms of thinking about objects and objects as things that one should engage with directly and try to understand where that thing comes from and what does it allow for. And object lesson rhetoric was very much used to do that.
How so?
Well, by explicitly talking about these materials as object lessons, by saying this is not just a piece of tin, but it's actually an object lesson in the McKinley tariff. And here's how you can try to think through this lesson. Or examples, if you look through you know, newspaper accounts of various tariff debates in the early 1890s, really seeing the phrase object lesson used repeatedly as a way to talk about the things that are being taxed. You know, this is, if we look closely at these textiles, we can see that this actually is an object lesson in what American manufacturers can produce or not. So there's a lot of language around close looking and around actually attending to the material things, as opposed to the ways they were abstracted during tariff debates and discussions by politicians.
So it's in many ways, it's exactly the opposite of the way most political conversations go, to greater levels of abstraction. They went kind of the reverse.
Well, I think when you're talking about very particular commodities or materials, I mean, that can often be an effective strategy, right? And in these cases, you know, that's what many politicians were doing. And then when you look at the list of objects to be taxed, the tariffs of this period, they actually look very similar to the kinds of lists of objects that you see in object lesson textbooks that are actually often organized in similar ways. And so imagining students really trained in this way of understanding objects in the material world, then potentially engaging with some of this political discourse, there's really a direct relationship, even formally, to the ways that information is presented, which is quite interesting.
As we're just about out of time, but I wanted, before we moved off, I want to touch on a couple things quickly, or not so quickly. But how did you get interested in this? How did you come across all this? It's like discovering a little subculture or culture, that opening a door of a room that you didn't know existed.
Yeah, it's quite an exciting project for those reasons. Because as I said, the metaphor is really completely hidden in this historic practice.
Yeah.
And even in talking with historians of education, you know, I've been told by some historians of education, which I'm not trained in history of education, my background's in American studies, but that, oh, you can't look at education transforming culture, you know, culture transforms education. Mm-hmm. But I think in history of object lessons, there's a bit of both happening.
Mm-hmm.
So I was in graduate school, and I was working on my, trying to figure out what I wanted to write my dissertation about. And I've always worked on material culture, on histories of object-based learning. That's something I studied, you know, as an undergrad, and then I got a master's in, and have worked in museums pretty much my whole life as a teenager. And I was looking through Harvard's many and wonderful library catalogs, and I kept coming across these texts that had titles like Object Lesson in the title, Object Study in the title. And it was quite fascinating to me to really sort of drill down and to figure out what are these texts? What are these books no one's talking about in material culture studies? And that brought me over to the Gutman Education Library at Harvard, where all of these historic textbooks were kept. And I found myself diving into these historic textbooks. And that then led me down this whole path when I realized, wait a minute, this phrase object lesson that a lot of contemporary material culture scholars like to use to talk about how they study the world has a prehistory.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a whole world of 19th century Americans interested in how we can study and think about the material world. And that was quite fascinating to me because I'm a person who's studied the 19th century, the long 19th century, for a long time. And from a material culture perspective, it's a very object-focused century because in terms of the way people talk about material things, the rise of the department store, mm-hmm. the rise of the modern museum, the way images could be published and shared so much more readily, you know, the realist literature, all of these different ways of really engaging with material things, which we think of as this, you know, 19th century abundance of objects, but, you know, historian Stephen Kahn has referred to, you know, as object-based epistemology of the 19th century.
Hmm.
And then suddenly realizing for me, wait a minute, there's actually a history to how people learn to think this way.
That's interesting.
And their actions.
Listeners might think that this is some kind of deep plan that I have, but it's not. Books show up in catalogs and they sound interesting to me, and I talk to people. But this is it's really quite extraordinary how you relate to two conversations I had in December, episode 91, Wanamaker's Temple, with Nicole Kirk, about basically the material culture of John Wanamaker's department store and the way that it was related to his Christianity and his ideas of the evangelical social gospel. It's very complex.
Mm-hmm.
But also in episode 89, when we talked about shoes, Georgian era shoes, with Kimberly Alexander. And Kimberly and I, we concluded by talking about how historians and teachers who are not historians of material culture might introduce material culture into the classroom. And I've tried to do it a little bit. I find it much more interesting and useful to give students, say, an 18th century newspaper printed in the printing shop at Colonial Williamsburg in good linen paper and typeset, than just giving them the text. It changes the way they think about what they're reading and about the past. How would you go about that? What would be your advice to someone who wants to do that but doesn't have your background?
Well, I think in almost any university setting, there are going to be some kind of collection of objects that you could engage with. And in a lot of other work that I've done, like, for example, Tangible Things, which is a book that I wrote with several colleagues, including Laurel Ulrich, Ivan Gaskell, and Sarah Schechner, we thought really hard about, you know, how do you work with university museum collections? So first, I would encourage any professor who wants to do that to think about what are the local collections that I have here that I could engage with. But you can also just think about what are some of the things that potentially, in your mind as maybe a subject expert, but not a material culture expert, what are things that feel like they might connect big questions or topics or possibilities, and then thinking about how you might go through a regimented approach to those objects to develop some of those bigger ideas. We have a series of videos that we created at Chipstone, sort of modeling how you could teach with the object lesson method in the classroom. So that's one thing, that's one way that we've done that, by starting with some objects in our collection and modeling ways you can move from that object by going through the steps of an object lesson to writing about that object. And I often find that a very helpful way to do it. For faculty members, though, who want to teach with objects, I think the most important thing for them to think about is that they are not necessarily going to be an expert in that thing. And that can be hard for faculty members to grapple with because they're used to typically being the expert in the room. And when you're engaging with a material thing, you are consciously sharing authority with your students. And that gets back to this notion of object study and object-based pedagogy as opening up one's mind, as being a way to teach critical thinking and reasoning. When you are teaching with a material thing in the classroom, you are, by definition, sharing authority because everyone with you is looking at that thing and observing that thing and having an observation and a response and having and developing their own questions. And I think developing comfort with looking closely, opening up questions about an object that you may not be able to answer, but recognizing that working collaboratively with your students, you can develop a whole range of interesting and meaningful questions, just as you would with any other historical source, I think can be a really exciting way to, train students to be deeper thinkers in the history classroom.
My guest today has been Sarah Ann Carter. She is the author of Object Lessons, How 19th Century Americans Learned to Make Sense of the Material World. And she is curator and director of research at the Chipstone Foundation in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Sarah, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
For more historical thinking, go to our Facebook page, where you can comment on today's program and suggest ideas for programs to come. Please subscribe to us on Apple iTunes. And if you like what you've heard, please, please leave a review so that others can find us. Our program's editor is John Rudat. I'm your host, Al Zambone. Talk to you next week.